From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If any doubts remained that the Bush administration authorized spying on American citizens, former National Security Agency analyst Russell Tice may have put them to rest late last month on MSNBC.
The National Security Agency had access to all Americans' communications. It didn't matter whether you were in Kansas, in the middle of the country, and you never made any foreign communications at all. They monitored all communications.
The agency had access to all Americans' communications, but Tice said they targeted individual journalists and news organizations. Many had suspected as much. In 2006, a group of journalists tried to sue the NSA to find out if they were being spied on. The suit was dismissed. One reporter who was sure he was being monitored was Lawrence Wright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. His first clue came from one of his sources in the intelligence community, who told him he'd read a summary of a phone call Wright had made to the Middle East. Later, two federal agents showed up at his door with questions about another phone number he'd called.
And they wanted to know, first of all, who was it? I looked it up on my Palm Pilot, and it belonged to a solicitor in London who represents some of the jihadis that I had been interviewing for my book. And then they began asking if the person on our end of the call, my end, was named Caroline. And that's my daughter's name. And they asked, is her name Caroline Brown? And I said, no, she's, a student at Brown. But I said, her name's not on any of our phones. How do you know this information? Are you listening to my calls? And they just shut their briefcases and left. I thought, as an American citizen, that the law was that they would not be listening to my calls unless they had a warrant. And I thought it's very unlikely that they would be able to obtain one because I'm a legitimate reporter. But a year later, there was a New York Times story breaking the news that there were illegal wiretaps on American citizens, and I realized then what was going on.
So was there anything in what Russell Tice said that surprised you?
No. What disturbed me is the law as it stood was that when American citizens or American persons, that including anybody who's in America at the time, when they're overheard in a conversation, that portion of the conversation is supposed to be what they call minimized. In other words, redacted. So I might be having a conversation that is monitored with a source. If that source is a foreign source, then the American intelligence community can report on it. But my part of it supposedly is taken out. What Tice was saying is that where American citizens are involved, they would put it into a discard pile. But he said that was the pile that they were monitoring. Mm. And that really concerned me because his allegations included the idea that they were monitoring not just individuals, but entire news organizations.
And what would be the point?
Well, for one thing, the reporters are doing the work that American intelligence has failed to do. Here's what worries me about it. I might be writing about Al-Qaeda one week, and I might be writing about the government the next week, our government. How do I know what the intelligence community is listening for and what use they're going to put it to? These revelations came out, about the illegal wiretapping at a time when the Bush administration was leading a campaign against the press. ABC News, for instance, broke a story, I think, in 2006 that they had been warned by government sources to change all their cell phones because they and the New York Times and the Washington Post were all being closely monitored for possible sources that they might have inside the intelligence community. I'm worried about not just my own privacy, but I'm worried about my sources.
Do you think that chilling effect you felt was felt among journalists who cover government and foreign policy?
Well, I've talked to other colleagues, and we've discussed, how do we behave in this? Do we behave like terrorists? Do we go out and, for instance, buy phone cards and discard the phones after we have an interview? What really concerns me is that I think it's had a chilling effect on the sources themselves because they're more jeopardized now than they were in the past.
We were a little surprised that there was so little coverage and less outrage over Tice's allegation. Why do you think that is?
I think in part is because Congress has essentially approved and legalized the formerly illegal actions of the Bush administration.
When the journalists brought their lawsuit back in 2006 and it was dismissed, what they were charging the government with doing was illegal. But you're saying that now, in 2009, because of acts of Congress, it would be legal.
It's a little unclear. You remember last year all the thunder and lightning that was going on in Congress about the illegal wiretaps, and then the laws that they approved essentially rubber-stamped what the Bush administration had done. There's another consideration. If you're a reporter or a news organization and you want to bring suit because you feel like your privacy has been invaded, then the government is entitled to discovery. That is, they can begin to look through your phone records and find out who else you've been talking to. Let's say that I'm doing an article for The New Yorker. The fact checkers also call my sources. Well, they also call Cy Hirsch's sources. So where does it stop? Will all of our sources be uncovered in the pursuit of a lawsuit that we have very little chance of winning? You know, there's not much incentive for a person like me to go out and sue the government if it's going to have the result of throwing my sources in jail and perhaps me as well.
The Obama administration has been very explicit about wanting more transparency in government and about reestablishing the rule of law. Do you think this is less likely to happen?
I don't see anything happening in this. I happened to just file a couple of Freedom of Information suits on a story that I'm working on, and they were blanketly rejected. I just don't think that the government is moving in the direction that the president has indicated.
Larry, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Brooke. Thank you.
Lawrence Wright writes for The New Yorker and is the author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11.
President Obama has promised to oversee a new era of transparency in government. One of his very first moves was to revive the ailing Freedom of Information Act. But even the best intentions can be thwarted by aging systems that aren't built to accommodate brave new futures. Slate columnist Fred Kaplan, who is, by the way, Brooke's husband, wrote about a report by the National Archives and Records Administration with troubling implications. It concluded, wrote Kaplan, that in an era when nearly all records are stored on hard drives rather than typed on paper, the raw bits of history are evaporating. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so your piece in Slate is fascinating because it reminds us that not everything produced within the federal government exists on paper to be archived. What other material is out there that's slipping through the cracks?
Well, almost everything in the Pentagon, if it's a briefing on a war plan, on a weapons procurement, it's all done on PowerPoint these days. And the National Archive is currently unable to accept and process either PowerPoint slides or Microsoft Word documents. So the National Archives are basically telling all the federal agencies, listen, we can't do anything with these now, so just hang on to them and file them rationally until we get around to it. They're currently—
Hold on. The National Archive is not equipped to accept Word documents.
Yeah, until a few years ago, they could not accept email with attachments, digital photos, or PDF documents. That's just in the last few years. They supposedly are putting together an electronic record archive, but it will not be ready for at least 3 years. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. You know, a dot-com firm can get started up, go bankrupt, and the guys could start a new dot-com firm in a year and a half. So beats me. Maybe
that's the miracle of the government procurement process, I'm sure. But does it behoove agencies to themselves store all of these Word documents and PowerPoint presentations until such time as the archives can process them?
They're supposed to, but an Air Force historian told me a few years ago that he was putting together the official Air Force history of the Panama operation. And he found out, almost by accident, that all of the briefings on the war plan were kept in this small Mac computer. He also found out that this small Mac computer was about to be thrown out. Not deliberately, just, okay, here's an old computer, let's get rid of it. He printed out all the documents from that computer, and those printouts are the only copies of those briefings that are in existence.
So we're not talking about an administration that is intentionally trying to erase history. It's just that the administrative infrastructure does not have the wherewithal to preserve any of this
stuff. That's right. You know, in the old days, when people used paper, what would happen is officials would write memos to each other. There'd be a secretarial pool that would type them up on carbons. Every once in a while, the archivist would come around with a cart and take away all the carbons. And so if you're an historian and you want to research World War II or the Kennedy administration or the Johnson administration, so you have a treasure trove of information. You can actually put together, you know, how the Vietnam War got started, this particular battle in World War II. My fear is that when historians 20 years from now go back and try to figure out why we invaded Iraq or Afghanistan, or even, you know, it's not just the Bush administration. It's about the Kosovo operation under Clinton or the Gulf War under the first President Bush. If somebody puts in a Freedom of Information request asking for documents related to X, Y, and Z, the answer might come back, sorry, no such documents exist.
Fred Kaplan, once again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate.com and is the author of Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power.
Coming up, one publisher says that the death of the newspaper is greatly exaggerated, and billboards that look back at you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Newspapers are dying. The newspaper, dry your eyes, will soon be dead. Or maybe it just seems that way because the media, as we've heard before, only report the bad news. So says a new website called The Newspaper Project, started by a handful of media executives, including the publisher of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Brian Tierney. The site hopes to balance what it calls, quote, negative gloom and doom stories about newspapers, so prevalent in the press. Because the real story, says Tierney, is just not getting out.
What's being missed in the confusion out there is the audience story. I mean, the fundamental challenge that everybody in media is dealing with now is one of competition. I saw this great quote from Lorne Michaels a few months ago saying that, you know, somebody asked him, what's the competition for Saturday Night Live? He said, Guitar Hero. The fact of the matter is that the newspaper print readership audience is holding up a lot better than other types of media, for instance, broadcast television, radio, etc. And when you add in the online audience of newspapers, we have more consumers of our journalism today than we had 10 years ago. But for whatever reason, it seems like newspapers take more of the flack than others do.
For absolutely obvious reasons, because newspapers are laying off 10, 20, 30% of their newsrooms. They're retrenching in many ways, closing bureaus, missing debt payments, selling for dimes on the dollar compared to what they sold for 3 years ago. This is an industry that is financially in extremis in a way that the other media aren't yet.
In many ways, I think there's a structural challenge to the story. There's probably, let's say, 15 publicly traded newspaper companies, and they release their earnings 4 times a year. So that's 60 times to talk about the financial aspects of the newspaper business. It's not a chance to talk about the audience aspect. Now, when NBC's advertising revenues are down, or ABC Broadcast Network's advertising revenues are down, that is a rounding error inside the General Electric quarterly numbers or the Walt Disney Company's quarterly numbers. So there's fewer broadcast networks. Their advertising revenue numbers and their decline in audience is buried inside of a much broader number. And I was joking with one person. I said, I could see you being upset if you were holding our debt, but you're just selling shoes. So aren't you pretty happy with the amount of people that pick up the paper to read about your shoe sales? And he said, yeah, I am.
You talked about how your overall audience is actually growing thanks to online readership. But the problem, Brian, unless I'm completely missing something, is that you simply cannot generate the kind of revenues with an online audience that you could with your print product. Isn't that the crux of your problem? That and, of course, the loss of almost all of your classified advertising revenue?
That is the crux of the financial challenge. I mean, for instance, when we got here, our web traffic, our online traffic was 20 million page views a month. This was 2.5 years ago. It's now 60 million page views. You could add up every television station, radio station, and newspaper in the market, and they don't have 60 million page views a month. Clearly, a free internet model online, if you build it, they will come, I don't think is working for media like ours. We have 400 journalists here. You could add up all of the media properties in the marketplace. They don't have 400 journalists. We have a value that others don't have, and I think we're going to have to start to find a way to charge for it and not just rely on advertising. I'm told that in the 60s, in the early 60s, the newspaper model was such that 40% of the revenue came from subscribers and 60% came from advertising. You know, a lot of papers have allowed that subscription number to get down to 20%. We, quite frankly, are up in subscription revenue over the past year because we're charging more for it and we're getting it. And I think we're going to have to figure out how to charge people some amount of money online as well to get our valuable content because nobody else has it.
The question is, how do you succeed at extracting money from people who have shown in the past at many other newspapers that they're just unwilling to pay it?
You've seen newspapers that have been able to charge it out in Little Rock, the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. You saw the Wall Street Journal was going to walk away from their $100 million or so of online revenue subscriptions and decided that didn't make sense. The other thing is you will see, I think, an increase in the paid subscription price for the printed paper. We jacked our price up from 50 cents to 75 cents, and all my competitors did the same thing, and they probably felt like carrying me around a sedan chair when I did it, and I think you'll see more of that. The research we did for that was I was in a local convenience store called a Wawa, and I saw somebody pick up the newspaper, pay $2.40 for something called a Sizzly, $1.59 for coffee, 50 cents for our paper, and only kept the sports section, gave everything back, and I thought, wow, if this guy thinks it's worth 50 cents, I think I can get 75. Newspapers have to kind of be a little bit more aggressive and a little bit savvier about what they have. And somebody says to me, well, you know, I can get my news on Yahoo or Google. Well, if you go into Yahoo and you type in Philadelphia News, the first 25 stories are mine. There's no Yahoo reporters running around Philadelphia.
I want to come back to the newspaper project. And I want to come back to it by way of reminding you of the early days of the collapse of the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just guessing that you were getting phone calls from real estate brokers, your advertisers, who were saying, what's with all this doom and gloom, man? It kind of reminds me, in fact, it absolutely reminds me of the tone of the newspaper project, which seems to begin from the assumption that the media are exaggerating the industry's woes. I mean, it all sounds very familiar to me.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, Bob. 34% of 18 to 34-year-olds in Philadelphia picked up a newspaper today. Our industry just isn't used to spin. There's something unseemly to promote ourselves. I mean, I have to remind my newsroom that when we send somebody behind the lines in Afghanistan, we have to put in the article and inquire exclusive. That marketing sense just isn't in our DNA. Over time, I do believe that if your audience is growing, we'll find ways to fix the financial part of the house.
Well, Brian, as someone who reads both of your papers every single day online for free, I wish you the best of luck.
Well, get the printed product, too.
Brian Tierney is the founder and CEO of Philadelphia Media Holdings.
Last week, we heard about how French President Nicolas Sarkozy is going to help French newspapers by buying a one-year subscription for every 18-year-old. Here in the U.S., we're kicking newspapers when they're down. Legislatures in South Dakota and Arizona are considering bills that would no longer require local governments to publish legal notices in the paper. They'd put them on government websites instead. If you've never read or even noticed a legal notice, you're not alone. They are these small print ads in the back of the paper where local governments and sometimes businesses let the public know what they're up to. Stuff like city council minutes and new construction projects. Maybe not the most exciting read, but they do provide a steady and sometimes vital stream of revenue for newspapers. Lee Templer of the East Valley Tribune in Mesa, Arizona, wrote an editorial against the proposed legislation. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So why do you think these notices should stay in the paper?
Well, for one thing, a variety of research shows that despite the current plight of the newspaper industry, people are still reading newspapers and their companion websites far more than they're reading individual government websites. We're talking at magnitudes of 10 to 100 times more. Also, newspapers serve as sort of a central repository. If you're a person who likes to know what different governments are up to around you, you can go to your local newspaper and read them all at once instead of having to go sit in the library all day and look through different minutes, or in the modern electronic era, hit individual websites.
But how many people really read these things? When's the last time you read a legal notice not in your capacity as a journalist?
Admittedly, I don't read them for fun. I would even disagree with some research I've seen lately that claims there's still a high number of people who read them. But they are read pretty frequently by certain industries, insurance investigators or lawyers who work on corporate affairs. There are people out there that do clip them or follow them on internet databases that have been created by newspapers. So they're still a vital source of information.
And how much revenue is generated by these notices?
Estimates range anywhere from, you know, 0.5% of your revenue to up to 10 or 15%.
So is your concern here more of an editorial one or a financial one?
From my perspective, it's an editorial one, and that I don't want to be in a position where governments basically are released from their obligation to share this information of what they're doing, particularly before a decision is made and nobody has an opportunity to act on it.
See, now that I don't get. If there is a law that insists that they publish it, then they have to publish it or else they're breaking the law. And then the newspapers can put them up on their websites. They don't have to be paid for the privilege of doing that.
That's correct. But the advantage is the printed page can't be changed. Internet sites can change at a moment's notice. It's not transparent when the item was available to be viewed and when it was taken down. Right now, whenever a government is questioned about whether they published a legal notice when they were supposed to, they just pull the tear sheet of the newspaper and show it to them with the date printed across the top. In some cases, newspapers have to provide a short affidavit saying, yes, the page you've been presented is an accurate representation of what we published that day. It's a much simpler, more cost-effective system for government the way it is handled now.
I don't know how it could be more cost effective. They're paying you, whereas they can do it themselves for free.
Well, they wouldn't be free, though, Brooke, because you'd have to go out and hire either internal staff or outside auditors to constantly monitor when notices were published on a website, how long they were left on the website, and that website was actually available to the public to view.
Who says that they have to do that?
If you don't do that, then there's no point in requiring publishing illegal notices. Because there's no way to be certain that a government is fulfilling its responsibility. Why even have the requirement at all? As long as you believe in the purpose of legal notices in the first place, you're going to have a verification system that they're being published in a timely manner.
So why do you think governments in South Dakota and Arizona are pushing for this change? Is this a cost-cutting measure exclusively, or do you think there's some nefarious effort to evade transparency requirements?
It's not nefarious today. It's strictly an effort to save money by, well, if we just put it on our own government websites, that doesn't cost us any more than we're already spending. That assumes there's no verification of such publication. But later on, what happens is without that verification, people will figure out, well, we can put the notice up for 2 minutes and then nobody will know how long it was up. Or we can put it up when somebody asks about it and then we can say, hey, look, it's there. And it'll become a lot easier to start ignoring the intent of publishing legal notices when it's in the government's hands to do the publishing versus they have to meet somebody else's deadlines in order to get it published on a printed page and out in front of a lot more readers than individual government websites.
So basically what you're saying is newspapers exist to act as a check on government.
Absolutely.
Where the hell did you come up with that?
Something about the First Amendment and freedom of the press to begin with, I'm not sure.
Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Lee Templer is editorial page editor at the East Valley Tribune in Mesa, Arizona.
you know when the nightmarish Philip K. Dick sci-fi future is upon us? When you look at a billboard and it looks back at you. You may remember that scene from the film Minority Report. Tom Cruise's character John Anderton walks into a store and is bombarded with ads that call him by name.
The road you're on, John Anderton, is the one less traveled. Make sure you
Good evening, John Anderton.
See ya, John Anderton.
Are we approaching the day when our billboards know us well enough to pitch their messages especially to us? Not yet, but maybe soon. Paolo Prandoni is chief scientific officer for the software company Quividy, and he's helped engineer real-life billboards with the ability to know and take note of who checks them out. Paolo, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So I'm at the mall, and I see a billboard there or some sort of sign, and what happens next?
Basically, our system is a souped-up turnstile that counts the number of people that are actually looking at the billboard and provides some extra qualifying information such as your gender and the amount of time that you spend looking at the content of the billboard.
My gender. Now, I'm not leaving any DNA behind. How does it know?
Well, it looks at your face, and according to your features, it can formulate a pre-educated guess as to whether you're male or female. So, for instance, if you have a beard, well, it pretty much gives it away. And other traits are more subtle, but it's a combination of different hints in a certain direction. So, for instance, long hair would tilt the system towards female gender, full lips as well, or high cheekbones, for instance. There are small hints that can be combined into a pretty cogent guess.
Long hair, full lips, high cheekbones. So if Fabio walks by, you're going to count him as a woman.
It's likely, yes. I don't know if it's a problem for Fabio, but it's a possibility.
But I understand you can also do age.
Age is a much more slippery quantity to assess because, of course, age and patterns are very different. So what we do is we try to define some broad categories where we differentiate, of course, between children and adults, and then we further split adults into younger adults and older adults and then senior. And again, the way we do that is by looking at features that somehow give away the age of a person, but we can't really attach a precise numeric value.
Okay, now, like many people, I don't like to have cameras trained on me when I'm not aware of it. Shouldn't I be alarmed that I can't even walk past a billboard without fear that a camera buried inside of it is scrutinizing my image?
Oh, dear. So that's a very, very controversial point. We don't record an image. And you're nothing more than just a head count with a little tag of attributes that are attached to it, such as your gender and your attention time. I think there's a little bit of technophobia that is attached to cameras. People are afraid of being scrutinized, and they're afraid of being read by an evil marketing system. But the truth of the matter is that the system is not that sophisticated, and again, people are just head counts.
What if the police come in with a search warrant and they say, oh, by the way, we need this for surveillance for one reason or another? Do you have the capacity to accommodate them?
No, we don't record anything, and I think the police would be much better off to have a system designed for video surveillance and maybe get a better view because a screen in the mall is not particularly big. The longer answer is wherever there is a camera, there is a possibility for recording, but that's not what we do.
Does the content of the advertisement change based on who you perceive to be watching it?
Right now, the gender counting is used mostly as a post facto analysis, but that's probably going to happen in the future. Instead of being bombarded by ads that do not really apply to us, we would move to a situation pretty much the same way that it happens on the internet, where the little ads that we get on, say, Gmail are not that irritating because they talk to us more than the useless droning of messages that do not really apply to us. I mean, advertisement is not 100% evil. There is an informative component of advertisement that we actually are very happy to have in our lives.
Bearing in mind that this conversation is being recorded, would you, as the chief scientific officer of Quividy, care to tell me what percentage of advertising is evil? 'Cause I'm dying to hear that number.
Well, In my opinion, for instance, advertisement that targets children is evil. And I am not against using my technology to switch off the billboard when the audience is composed of children, for instance. And that would be a great service.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paolo. I appreciate you talking to us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Paolo Prandoni is the chief scientific officer for Quivity, a French software company.
Up next, one journalist's foiled plan to report from the land of her fathers, Iran, and the spy who loved us, or so he said.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 30 years ago this week, the Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of Iran's revolution, ended his 14-year exile outside of Paris, boarded an Air France flight, and flew home to Tehran. Soon after his return, the Islamic Republic of Iran was born. That was in 1979. Journalist and author Azadeh Moveni was just 2 years old at the time and growing up a world away in California. But as an adult, she's spent many years reporting in Iran. In her new book, Honeymoon in Tehran, Moveni writes about living and working in the Iranian capital. One challenge she faced, her government minder. A man who for years intimidated her, scrutinized her work, and had ultimate say over her freedom to do it. She called him Mr. X because she never knew his real name. Their relationship was both terrifying and bizarre.
I think I describe it in my book as having a jealous boyfriend, because that's what it would often feel like, you know, phone calls where he would complain, "Where have you been? You haven't called me. I don't know what you've been doing." It was a very hectoring relationship that was mostly conducted on the phone. I would call or he would call, and we were meant to not introduce ourselves. And so this created this very sort of bizarre intimacy.
But I'm still wondering, how does it work?
He would often ask me to meet in empty hotel apartments in secluded parts of town. And he would always have someone else, so we were usually never alone. But it was always very scary because I felt like I was disappearing into a building where, you know, I might never emerge. I mean, who would hear me? And I always had a code with my driver who would take me. You know, he would call 10 minutes into the meeting, and I would say, "Yes, I'll be back for dinner." That meant everything was fine. So that was my only escape route that I had constructed for myself.
Did you hate this guy?
Mr. X was both good cop and bad cop. So when he acted as though he wanted to try and sincerely help me, I felt grateful to him. And at moments when he was being the horrible, intimidating Mr. X, I despised him. I felt cornered and absolutely at his mercy.
You wrote that in Iran, there are no neutral stories. Give me an example of a story that you thought might be neutral but wasn't.
I thought I would write about how Iranian classical music was making a comeback. The government was very deliberately trying to present itself as being culturally tolerant. But when you write about this, for example, you have to write that in 1979, they banned instruments being shown on television. Musicians were banned from carrying instruments in public. And so it seemed to me there was no way of avoiding this troubled revolutionary history in anything that I could write.
Toward the end of your memoir, you're informed that a trial has been started against you for your reporting. Why? And what does that even mean in Iran?
That means that there is a paranoid element of the regime that considers you or your work as part of the American plot to overthrow the government. Mm-hmm. And that therefore, whatever you've been doing, whether it's journalism or academic work or think tank work, is suddenly going to be trumped up in a court and presented as some sort of plot to undermine national security or to defame the regime. And in a handful of cases has brought the accused individuals into prison.
What happened with your trial?
Nothing ever came to pass. I sort of holed up inside the house for 2 months, quaking in fear. And after 2 months, I went back to the government press office and everything was sunny and as though I had never been told this. So I just assumed that it was the worst of, you know, a long series of scare tactics. And I tried to persuade myself to go on as though I'd never heard such a thing.
Did the word Kafka-esque go through your mind? I mean, one theme that emerges from your book is the arbitrary nature of these regulations against citizens, including and especially journalists. You can never be sure whether your reporting will get you into deep trouble or just be totally ignored.
It's impossible to anticipate what is going to upset or aggravate a censor in the Islamic Republic. The most benign, trivial thing that you might, as a journalist, think would never be the one thing that would get you in trouble can sometimes end up being the one definitive thing that is always held against you.
You write a lot in the book about how deeply you wished to live and work as a journalist in Iran, and of your frustration towards the end of the book when concerns for your own safety forced you and your family to move to London. In retrospect, what do you make of the fact that you really tried it and it just didn't work?
It's quite disheartening for me. It was for me the definitive moments that I realized, you know, Iran right now is a country that doesn't belong to me and that I can't belong to. Maybe I wasn't steely enough, you know, to work under that kind of pressure, but it was very painful.
Your government minder tells you at one point that you've been allowed to work in Iran even after the publication of your last book, Lipstick Jihad, which criticized the regime. He said, in effect, how can you think of us as so repressive if we've let you come back and report?
It was a fair enough point, and I conceded it at the time because for a government that's so often portrayed as just black and white, just utterly repressive, there's very often a significant amount of freedom accorded to us. To me, it shows that the Islamic Republic is evolving. One thing I want to point out is that, for example, in 1953, when there was an American and British coup against the democratically elected prime minister of Iran at the time, journalists were on the payroll. As part of that coup, they participated, they wrote newspaper stories that helped bring about the downfall of, you know, the only Democrat that's been leading the country in the last century. And that's a history that the government lives with every day. And so even though they're quite paranoid to a ridiculous degree, they have a recent history of being plotted against by people just like me.
How well served are Iranians by their own press? How good a job are they able to do?
The press in Iran since the 40s and 50s, before the revolution, has just often been unprofessional. It's been propaganda, and that's something that has been bemoaned by Iranians for decades, even before this Islamic revolution.
And yet courageous papers start up and are shuttered all the time.
They do. It's constantly happening. I mean, even just in the last month and a half, for example, a paper very courageously printed a statement by a student group that called Hamas a terrorist organization. You know, to print such a thing under a government that's Hamas's number one cheerleader is very brave. And it was shut down, but everyone read it. And these are the things that will slowly bring about plotting change in Iran.
Azadeh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Azadeh Moveni is a contributing writer for Time magazine. Her new book, Honeymoon in Tehran, was published this week by Random House.
For much of the Vietnam War, Time magazine employed one of Saigon's most successful reporters, the first Vietnamese staff correspondent for a major U.S. outlet, Pham Swan An. An earned his reputation as dean of the Vietnamese press corps through his many military sources, his strict work ethic, and his keen grasp of facts in the fog of war. By 1975, he was the magazine's sole journalist in the country, maintaining the Saigon Bureau single-handedly for the next year. But in the war's aftermath, An eventually reported something else. a secret he'd been keeping for nearly 30 years. He was a spy for the North Vietnamese and had actually helped plan the Tet Offensive. Shortly before his death in 2006, An spoke to Thomas Bass for a New Yorker story that eventually grew into a book called The Spy Who Loved Us, a book published this month by Public Affairs. We also spoke to Bass in 2006, and he told us that An was responsible for the deaths of Americans, but he did save the life of at least one, fellow Time correspondent Robert Sam Anson, who had been captured by North Vietnamese soldiers.
At great personal risk to himself, An sent word Anson should not be killed. Anson was not killed. He was released, flew to Saigon, walked into the offices of Time magazine and wrapped Pham Son Anh in a big bear hug and thanked him for saving his life. Anson didn't know that An had saved his life. He just suspected that he had. And Anson, to this very day, works with a photograph of Pham Son Anh over his desk.
One of the most interesting things about your piece is that while he was working as an agent for the North Vietnamese, he was doing pretty good journalism simultaneously. How can those two thoughts be held, you know, in your head at the same time?
The secret to his success, he always maintained, was that he never told a lie, that he always told precisely the same story to people at Time magazine as he told to the North Vietnamese. He was taking information that was leaked to him. He would write it up using secret ink, and then it would be run right out to the North Vietnamese, where Ho Chi Minh was reported to have clapped his hands and exclaimed that he had the feeling as if he were overhearing conversations in the U.S. Department of Defense. Pham Son Anh's reporting was so accurate and precise.
In fact, at one point, someone in Time management asked if they had been duped by him, said, well, no, on the contrary, we would have made fools of ourselves at various points had he not stepped in to explain that we had the story wrong.
There are many reporters for Time magazine, including their former bureau chiefs, who maintain that An saved Time magazine from making lots of errors. Many of these mistakes were, in fact, information that Time magazine was getting out of Washington, D.C. Pham Son Anh knew better and could often correct its course. You know, there's this charge that's been lobbed against him that he, by definition, of course, must have planted disinformation in Time magazine. Well, first of all, Time magazine, by definition, was full of nothing but disinformation. It was stridently and ardently pro-war for many, many years. And I don't think that that was An's function at all. He tried to be as precise and accurate in dealing with information as he could, which is what he learned when he attended school in the United States and studied journalism here.
How did he first come to be a spy for the North Vietnamese, and then how did he land the gig at Time?
The North Vietnamese intelligence agencies arranged for him to study in the United States. When he returned to Vietnam, Pham Son Anh was put in charge of all of the Vietnam news agency's foreign correspondence. So at that point, he was actually almost a quadruple spy. He had worked for French intelligence, he worked for CIA, he worked for the South Vietnamese intelligence, and he also worked assiduously and throughout his life for North Vietnamese intelligence. And his integrity and his news sense was so acute and noticed by so many people that he was hired by Reuters for a few years, and then Time magazine hired him.
There were hints along the way that would have suggested, if you were paying very close attention, that An simply had too much information.
There are examples of journalists actually being out in the field and following various campaigns and coming back and chatting with An about these campaigns. And he would set them straight on what they'd actually seen in a way that dumbfounded them. Several people noted this. Nick Turner, An's first boss at Reuters, was one of those people who noticed that An knew too much. Most people attributed his knowledge to CIA contacts. They never thought they were North Vietnamese contacts.
You spoke to his former colleagues. When it was revealed that he had been who he was, were they angry? Did they feel themselves betrayed? Shrug? What?
I think there's remarkable understanding on people's part that An was simply caught at a particular historic moment, and the choice on his part to act as a patriot and a nationalist meant the United States was only an accidental enemy, like the Japanese, like the French, who had attempted to occupy Vietnam and had to be defeated. It was Phum Son Ann's hope that after defeating the United States that he could get back to what he cared about, that was being friends with the United States. And then there are people like Peter Arnett who feel that this is, as I say, a betrayal of the profession.
Arnett is not expressing some hypothetical point of disagreement. When you're a journalist and a spy simultaneously, you're putting all other journalists under suspicion, and you are putting them all at risk of their lives, to say nothing of their credibility.
You're absolutely right that every time journalists double as spies, it puts those of us in the profession at risk. But we should not pretend to any virtue here. Many spies have worked for Time magazine. Of course, most of the spies who've worked for Time magazine, at least the spies that we know of, were in fact working for the Central Intelligence Agency. There's that very famous example of Time magazine bureau chief, Mr. N.O. Habin, who was in 1954 moved from Paris into Guatemala, where he led the coup d'etat while working out of the offices of Time. Very rarely do people do both things well. Phum Son Ann is one of those rare examples of someone. He was a brilliant journalist and obviously also a brilliant spy.
Thomas A. Bass is a professor of English at the University at Albany. We originally spoke with him in 2006. This month, his book-length account of Ann's spying will be published, uncovering more of this bizarre saga. Thomas, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You did a great deal of new reporting, expanding on your original piece in The New Yorker. Among other things, you found out that he had not been awarded 4 medals by the North Vietnamese government, but 16. He was far more active than even you imagined.
Well, this is the problem when you try to write the story of a spy. Phum Son Ann, he pretended that he was nothing other than a strategic analyst, that he looked at the war from a kind of Olympian distance. But actually, he had in fact been involved in choosing the targets to be attacked during the Tet Offensive. And that's not strategic intelligence, that's tactical intelligence. That's actually the stuff that wins or loses battles. Then I discovered a long list of battles and military engagements and campaigns where he was, in fact, moving troops around in the field and sighting targets. And he was North Vietnam's one of their major military weapons in terms of winning the war.
Now, as a direct consequence of your piece in The New Yorker, a lot happened, including changes in your relationship with Ann himself before he died. The story came out, then what happened?
He and I had one final meeting after the long New Yorker article came out about him. We talked long into the night, as we often did. But at that meeting, he told me he would never see me again. He told me that I was reporting his story from inside Vietnam, which was a kind of cryptic way of saying that I was revealing things in the West that people did not want revealed. And I was, of course, disappointed and hurt. But I also realized at that point that I was onto something important, that this was a story that I should continue reporting.
Well, on the subject of friendship, as we've just heard in your original piece, various of Ann's colleagues during the course of the war told you that, on balance, they still regard him as a friend, in some cases even a hero. He may have been a spy, but he was really telling the North Vietnamese no more than he was telling the editors and readers of Time magazine. Have those sources of yours rethought the way in which they cherish Ann's memory?
In a way, Phum Son Ann, he was such a successful spy that he not only had his first cover story, which was that he was nothing other than a reporter for Time magazine, but he also had a second cover story after his identity was revealed, that he was a friendly spy. He was a spy who always loved America. Well, the whole thrust of my book is that during the Tet Offensive, for example, he was involved in driving around Saigon and sighting the targets that would be attacked. Well, people were killed in those attacks. Phum Son Ann's loyal friends, they don't believe me. They don't like this news. And there are those people who used to talk to me at great length about their friend Phum Son Ann, and now they hang up the telephone when I call, or they yell at me, or they refuse to take my phone calls.
All right, Thomas, once again, thank you so much.
Pleasure talking to you again.
The Spy Who Loved Us, The Vietnam War, and Phum Son Ann's Dangerous Game is available February 16th. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.